This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Today, I'm going to tell you a story of repair and regeneration of our body. So, if you are like me as a naughty child, you must have actually have experiences such as grabbing a tail of a lizard. And you can actually imagine, you probably actually remember, that the lizard would shake off, quickly ran away, left a piece of tail in your hand. However, this lizard will have totally regenerated his own tail functionally, fully, in 2 weeks. In fact, if you cut out the lizard's eye, it will grow a new eye in 2 weeks, and a seeing eye. If you cut out half of this heart, you'll grow a new heart, which is still going to be. If you cut out his half of the brain, it will grow a new brain and a function to tell its whole body to move. So, why can the mammals and humans cannot do it? So, since we just finished a very contentious presidential election, I will submit to you that Newt is a better president, better than Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, in the nation of regenerative medicine. So it would be very wonderful or nice if human beings can regenerate a damaged tissue. For example, a soldier lost a limb in a war. I'm going to tell you a story that for the first time we will make this a reality. Showing here is just a schematic diagram of eye. I'm an eye doctor. I want to cure blindness. So one of the largest or most common blindness is called cataract. Cataract is basically a cloudy of the lens. Lens is actually in front part of the eye, which used to focusing light, such like in the retina. You can think about eye as a camera. So the lens is actually a lens of the camera focusing light in the film, which is eye equivalent of camera. Obviously, cloudy lens or cataract will block vision, causing blindness. So one of the ways to think about this is actually, can we regenerate our own lens using patient's own stem cell after cataract surgery? So traditionally, or if you're now going to an ophthalmologist's office having a cataract surgery, what you have to end up with is actually a very big incision in the front part of the eye called ACCC, and this is a 6-meter incision will allow the ophthalmologist to have access to the cataract and taking out the cataract. However, I will tell you just in a minute, by doing this, the procedure destroyed about 80% of the stem cell in the eye, will not allow the lens to regenerate. In fact, the picture on the right side, on the right side of your view, some of the children which undergo cataract surgery, however, they have robust residual stem cell that regenerate partially the lens. However, those lenses are not functional because they have scar tissue in the middle. So our hypothesis is actually, can we somehow harness the power of our own body, turn them on, and regenerate the tissues, organs that have been damaged? We want to try this in lens after cataract surgery, so you don't have to having a piece of plastic put into your eye after the cataract surgery. In order to prove this, we first have to know whether the stem cell can regenerate a lens. We turn into this model organism called mouse, where we label this lens stem cell with a green fluorescent protein, an algae protein, which was discovered by late Roger Chan, Nobel laureates in this campus. As you can see from here, the entire green lens was coming from one single lens stem cell, and it can regenerate a very beautiful green lens. Having demonstrated that, we also show that all those dots are single lens stem cell in the anterior part or front part of the lens. And you can see that, however, the cataract surgery, current cataract surgery, will destroy 80% of them. We was able to isolate the lens stem cell and show it in the culture dish here. And you can see from the lower panel, by differentiating them in the dish, petri dish in the laboratory, we can generate mini lenses which can magnify letters. So, and then in order to figure out a way to preserve those stem cells and generate a functional lens in patients' own eye, we designed a new surgical procedure where we actually made a very small incision in the patient's lens, and which allow maximum preservation of the stem cell, and then give them this natural environment so they can grow their own lens. We did this by testing first in rabbit models of lens regeneration. Showing here is the pictures. You can see on the top that within 6 to 7 weeks, we were able to generate a functional new lens from the rabbits who undergo cataract surgery. This is a regenerated lens. This is a normal lens as a comparison. You can see they are very similar. Now, having done this, we went on to the primate model. In the monkey, we did a similar thing. You can see here that the monkey also can regenerate the new lens. And this lens, however, is going to be a little slower. It's about 5 to 7 months. However, regenerated lenses are nearly identical to the natural lens. And you can see a clear view of the retina in the back. Having studied the animal models, we went on to test this hypothesis in a clinical trial in infants with congenital cataracts. Those are infants that are born with a cataract, and those are actually very severe cataracts that blocks the vision of the infant. We have to remove those cataracts right away, otherwise the image of the external environment cannot be transmitted to the retina and to the brain. And it's like a computer have all the hardware, does not have the software. Obviously, it's not functional. And this will make the infants permanently blind. So this is very important and essential to take out the cataracts right away after the infant's born. By designing a cataract surgery, which has very small incision, take out the cataracts, and then facilitate, allow the lens to regenerate in the patient's or infant's eye, we're able to show that it's actually they have much reduced complication rate. In fact, if an infant now going to the surgery, the entire lens had to be removed. It's a very involved procedure with lots of complications, including increased intraocular pressure with lifelong poor visual outcomes and blindness. What we show in this clinical trial, which we done 24 eyes with the infants as compared to 50 eyes with the traditional surgery, we have remarkably good visual outcome with 19-fold decreased complication rate. Showing here is an example of this, and this is, again, before surgery, the eye has cataract, and after surgery, it's entirely clear. This is just a small incision that a little scar left outside the visual axis. The patient can see very well and being functional very, very nicely in life. So what I show you today is a remarkable transformation of how we think about regeneration and repair of our own tissue. Traditionally, people think about stem cell and regenerative medicine. People think about growing stem cell in a petri dish in a laboratory and then take those cells, put it back into the patient's body, and hope that patients will be able to regenerate or gain some function. However, transplantation or stem cell research like this has a lot of risks, such as rejection, infection, and also some tumor formation. By turning on patients' own stem cell or harnessing our own stem cell power, we should be able to achieve the similar goal without those complications. Just imagine if we can do this, not just for our lens, but for our eyes, for our heart after heart attack, for our brains after neurodegeneration, such as Parkinson's and Alzheimer's disease, that the life and also the world will be so much better from now on. So this is actually a patient that is actually in China who have undergone this surgery, now have regained the vision. You can see such a bright future for this little kid. I want to thank you and also thank the chancellor for this wonderful opportunity to tell you the research in my laboratory. And then I also want to thank the postdoc fellows, Jie Zhu, who's in the audience, who led the study in my laboratory, and many of my patients and supporters and donors, Dick Hertzberg, Carl Hertzberg, and Michael Martin, and Richard Annesers, who actually supported my research. And I also want to thank you for your attention. Okay, so the question is, did we inject the cells into the baby cell or its own patient's baby's own stem cell. This is actually the most important part. It's baby's own stem cell. We turn on the baby's own dormant stem cell so it can repair itself. So this is actually a new concept. We essentially, if somebody has some damage, we can just figure out a way to turn on their own tissue to regenerate. Usually the cataract happens in older population. How does the young child develop cataracts? In the young children who has cataracts, usually there's a mutation in one of the genes at encoding lens proteins that is causing the cataract. I also want to have extension of your question. So we show this in the infants, but infants has robust stem cells. However, we also show that this type of regeneration can also be possible in adults such as us. Even that the stem cell population decreases with age, we show in this Nature paper just published this year that by surgery or there's a way to turn on those dormant stem cells so you can regenerate the entire functional lens. One of the benefits of actually having your own lens grow back again is actually you're going to regain accommodation. It means you don't have to have reading glasses. I'm giving you a pair of eyes or lens which is 20 years old. Very great question. So the question is, if the cause of a cataract is a mutation in a gene, even you had let it regrow back again, you cannot guarantee perhaps the cataract will reoccur again. It's true that most likely this is actually going to be a scenario. However, there were different ways that we can actually do this. We actually published another paper last year to show that we can actually create a cataract drop. Traditionally, cataract has to be done with surgery. We now actually have invented a drop which can give it to the patient to dissolve cataracts in the eye. But this is actually going to be doing most likely for the early cataracts. So to answer your questions, even there's actually a chance the cataract can reoccur. So we can actually have a combination of growing the lens and also prevent the cataract from forming again using the eye drops. So the question is that if a person has undergone cataract surgery, can the stem cell be used for glaucoma? So in the glaucoma, in the cataract operation, what can be done is actually when you do this operation, you can actually put in something else if you have a glaucoma for actually rescuing the retinal ganglion cell, which is the root of the glaucoma. So it's a different problem, but by taking out cataracts, you can actually do something simultaneously treat the glaucoma using stem cell. So how do you turn on the patient's own stem cell? So this is actually a $1 billion question because we show we can turn it on by just trick the dormant lens stem cell and give a proper environment and also probably putting some actually nice biomaterials and just something to boost them up. And I think for brains, and you have to somehow supply some trophic factors to tell them to proliferate. For the heart, I think there's just a recent paper that's following our lens regeneration paper that by giving proper environment, the key is actually giving the dormant stem cell proper environment so you wake them up and then give them some material or some nutrition so they can grow. So essentially you want all the stem cell to recapitulate, relive what we have done, which is a fetal development. So when you're a fetus, you grow everything. You can grow everything. So you turn on that process again. And so that's why I say, you know, I can give you a pair of eyes, which is actually 20 or actually only 20 years old.
One of the reasons that I was so excited to come to UCSD is that my research is at the intersection of psychology and neuroscience. And for those of you who do not know, neuroscience has made incredible breakthroughs in about the past 20 years, especially the past 5 to 10 years. The neuroscience community here at UCSD and at the Salk is just unparalleled. It's a wonderful place to work. Now, on top of that, I'm in the psychology department, which since its inception has been one of the top psychology departments in the country. And what I got really excited about is some of the work I do. The initial founders of the department were the ones who built the very basic psychological questions that now I investigate in the brain. So what do I investigate? I'm really interested in how the brain controls actions, right? We decide to make actions every day. We can decide to go for a walk or a run. We decide to have a cup of coffee. We want run or walk because it's healthy for us. We enjoy it, maybe. We drink coffee because it's delicious. And a lot of times we find ourselves making the same action over and over and over again. It becomes habitual. Now, habits are incredibly important. They allow us to move very efficiently in our world. We don't have to stop and reevaluate everything. But we also need to stop when it's detrimental, right? When we need to change our behavior. For example, if all of a sudden we have an increased caffeine sensitivity, we're staying up at night, we need to reduce how much we drink. Now, that seems kind of eh, but habits are fundamental to a lot of disease processes. So a common example is addiction, where a person continues their drinking or their drug-taking behavior in spite of extreme negative consequences. Obsessive-compulsive disorder, where someone performs very ritualistic, compulsive-like behaviors and cannot stop, can't break it, and it severely impairs their quality of life. And also gambling, where someone, even though they're losing all of their money, keep putting up everything they have to try to get ahead. And so I've talked to you, or I've mentioned these very human problems and human behavior, but fun for me, habits are seen across species. So this is my grad student, Drew, my first grad student, so that's kind of fun. But his decision-making depends upon a part of the brain called the frontal cortex, okay? So that same part of the brain, that same frontal cortex, is seen in monkeys, so rhesus macaques. We've seen habits in rhesus macaques. And then if you can see that really small circle up there, that's a mouse. Mice have a frontal cortex, and we can see habits in mice. And this is really great for me, because as a neuroscientist, we can now employ tools to really probe how the brain controls habits. So this is a picture from the frontal cortex of a mouse, and this is called the rainbow mouse, because you can see all these different lovely colors up there, right? What we're able to do now is genetically isolate very specific neurons. And these specific, each of those little circles, that's a different neuron in the cortex. And we can control the activity of these neurons. So that means that we can ask how very specific parts of the brain, very specific neurons in the brain, are controlling why we make an action. But kind of comes back to how can we study habits in mice. So most of you have probably heard of a Skinner box, right? Rat pressing a lever. Well, here's going to be a video. That's a little mouse. And it's in a little Skinner box. And what happens is a lever comes out, and the mouse, just by exploring its environment, learns that it can press that lever and get a food pellet. Mice will readily self-initiate and work for food. They'll press a lever multiple times, you can see it, and then retrieve a little food from that food receptacle. To investigate habits, what we can do is we can train a mouse, like you saw, to press a lever for a fun food reward. After they've learned to press this lever, what we can do is we can devalue that food outcome, right? So imagine if your coffee suddenly tastes really horribly bitter and not in a good way. But what we can do is we can take that food reward that they pressed the lever for and we can pair it with illness. So if they ate it, they get sick. Or we can give it to them as much as they want so that they no longer want it. But the main idea is that we change the value of what they're working for. And after we've changed that value, we just put them back in that box the next day. We let them press the lever. This time there's no food. But we just ask them, do you want to press this lever or not? So I bet you guys all have some guesses about what you would expect. But you can see here, there's two different bars. Okay, that lower bar is something we call goal-directed. That means if you change the value, you make that food reward gross, they no longer want to press. They're not going to press. They don't care anymore. However, if the animal is habitual, they'll keep pressing. Now, this same phenomenon, we can examine it in slightly different ways, but we've seen it across mice, rats, pigeons, monkeys, and humans. So the same task can be applied across many different species, and it's how we can examine how the brain controls habits. So I'm going to tell you about one type of tool we use in the brain to probe how different neural circuits work. And it's called DREDS, okay? And it's a way we control the brain activity. So what are DREDS? Neuroscientists engineered a receptor. It's called the muscarinic receptor, and it actually is a human receptor that they engineered to only be activated by a particular drug. So that means that there's nothing in your body that can activate this receptor. It's only if you give the animal the drug will this receptor be active. So they made this receptor. Okay, that's nice. But what we can do is we can take the DNA that codes for the gene for this receptor. We take that DNA and we insert that gene into very specific neurons in the brain. Now, what happens is that neurons normally communicate by firing. They talk to each other through these chemical and electrical impulses. So what happens when this drug, if you give this drug, it's going to activate this receptor only in those neurons, and we can make this neuron talk more. We can make the neuron fire. So it's a way for us to control the neural activity of a very defined set of cells. So what we want to do is we want to use this tool to investigate how the brain performs habits. So this is a picture of the mouse brain, or schematic of the mouse brain, if you were just to cut it down, the mouse's head down the middle. Okay? So up on top, you can see that this upper layer is the cortex up there. Now, the cortex controls behavior through its projections down into the basal ganglia. I'm sure most of you have heard of the basal ganglia. It's where changes happen in Parkinson's. So the cortex controls behavior down through the basal ganglia, and what we want to do is we want to control the activity of a particular part of the cortex called the orbital frontal cortex, which has been heavily implicated in how we make decisions, but no one knows exactly how. So what we do is I take a virus that's coding for this dread receptor and it's carrying all this viral DNA, and I inject it into the brains of mice, and what's going to happen is it's going to go only into certain OFC neurons that I've pre-identified via genetic means. And what we do is we put a fluorescent tag on it so we can see it. So all those little red dots, those are neurons in the mouse brain that are expressing this receptor. This means that if I give the mouse a drug, those neurons are going to increase their firing. So we take these mice where we have this virus expressed in their brain, we train them to press a lever for a food, and then just during that test session when I ask them, do you want to press a lever, are you habitual or not, we give the drug. So what we see in control mice is you see that high bar, it's at 100%, these animals are habitual. If you change the outcome, it doesn't matter, they just keep pressing. However, when we give animal a drug, we disrupt habits and we break habits and we let the goal-directed system take over. By increasing the activity of this orbital frontal cortex, which through additional studies we've shown controls goal-directedness, by increasing its activity, we can have the goal-directed system win out over the habit system. Now, that's just mice, right? So what does this actually mean for people? And what's been some of the most rewarding aspects of my work is its application to humans in clinical settings. So this same region, this orbital frontal cortex, has been found across diseases to be perturbed. So you put people with OCD or with addictions or with schizophrenia, you put them in an fMRI scanner and you look at the activity of this brain area during different tasks, you see that it's altered, but no one knew exactly how or why or how this led to aberrant behavior. So through our work and some others, if we found that actually, if we actually increase the activity of this brain area, it seems that increasing the activity of this brain area helps people overcome some of these disruptive behaviors. So how can we increase the brain activity in people? One way has been deep brain stimulation, right? That's been used to treat Parkinson's, but there's also a newer technique called transcranial cortical stimulation, where you place magnets on top of a person's head and you can direct a magnetic field down to a very specific brain area. So by doing these types of studies in this orbital frontal cortex, it's helped people stop their persistent or more automatic habitual type of behaviors. So we're really excited about this, but of course it raises a lot of questions. So some of the things that I'm doing here in my lab now, which I'm really excited about, is that we're asking how very specific diseases change this circuit. So I'm in particular looking at how alcoholism changes there, or how an alcoholic brain uses these circuits. We're also asking, are there different drug therapies that we can target that would selectively restore this type of behavioral control? And then kind of more fundamentally is, what does this tell us about the brain works? Because what happened is I can take out a habit system and have a goal-directed system take over. We know there's these two fundamental pathways in the brain. What we're trying to do is understand how they work to get together to control our behavior and then how that's perturbed. But with that, I'll end and I'll take any questions. Yeah, so the question was about brain injury versus brain disease. So I think most people think about brain injuries as like a stroke, right? Or some kind of physical damage. Now, what's been interesting is when there's been a stroke in this area, you see the same type of effects. People seem to be more habitual. They can't stop and evaluate their behavior. But at this point, there's a lot less that we can do for that. Brain diseases, if they haven't gone too far, there may be a way to try to pull the proper activity of that brain region back and try to restore it, or at least help it overcome some of its limitations. Yeah, so the question is about what about for younger people versus older people? So unfortunately, younger people's brains, but this is a good thing too, right? They need to learn. They're more plastic. They're more open to change. But that doesn't mean that these circuits stop working in old people. They work just fine. And so it seems, there doesn't seem to be any age discrepancy. And it seems like generally, and even in older people, that you can still try kind of retrain the brain, I guess. Though I hesitate with that language, but retrain the brain is one way to think about it. Yeah, so the question is there really any genetic underpinning to being biased toward habits? Now, those studies just haven't been done. There's a lot of similar type of things. We can think about impulsivity or some similar things where they have looked at the genetic contribution a bit more. But so far, we don't know anything about the genetic underpinnings of habits. Yeah, so the question is, do males and females differ at all in their habits? And you could imagine how that does. There's male hormones, there's female hormones, and they affect and change the brain. Once again, we see habits fairly similar in males and females, but that question hasn't been that investigated. Where we start to see some differences is in diseases, where maybe males or females may be more susceptible to one disease, and hence it affects their habits. But no one has gotten to targeting that question yet. Specifically. Yeah, so the question is there another way we can target the brain activity besides drugs or some kind of very invasive technique? So I'm not a big fan of like the brain training exercises per se, but there are very specific ways we can recruit these circuits. And so what cognitive clinical psychologists have been doing is taking addicts into the clinic, and these people have been absent for a long time. And they're trying to have them do tasks which we know recruit this part of the brain. And hopefully by recruiting it, that those circuits will be strengthened. So the more you use the brain, the better it is. So there is something to it. It's just it needs to be very focused and directed. Yeah, so the question is, was I saying something about magnetic fields and on the brain? And I was. It's not what I do, but there's this called transcranial magnetic stimulation where they put a magnet coil and they can basically locate pretty specifically, though there's some spread, very specific parts of the brain. You can't go too deep. It has to be pretty shallow, but you can, by applying a magnetic current to the brain, change how those neurons activate or turn on and fire. And so a lot of really nice work is starting to be done with that. And so far mostly it's been in motor control, but they're starting to apply it to depression and habit and OCD. And they're seeing some really interesting, nice effects that are making their way into the clinics now.
Hello, welcome to the celebration of research here at UC San Diego. My name is Mark Hanna. I study early American history as well as the history of the British Empire. Here I teach courses on surveys of early American history as well as the golden age of piracy and the age of sail. I'm also the honorary curator of the Hill Collection of Pacific Voyages, and I'm the founding associate director of the Institute of Arts and Humanities, recently begun here in July. Today I'm going to briefly talk about my recent book, Pirate Nests and the Rise of the British Empire, 1570 to 1740, and then I'm going to relate it to my experience teaching here at UC San Diego. They don't actually commit acts of piracy, but you'll see. Pirate Nests analyzes the rise and subsequent fall of international piracy from the perspective of colonial maritime communities. Depictions of pirates in popular culture, as well as in serious historical works, traditionally depicts pirates as simply swashbuckling adventurers relegated to a life at sea. After years of research, I found that early modern piracy flourished in the Caribbean, the Pacific, and the Indian Ocean because of the active support it received from colonial maritime communities and the merchant elite living on land. Far from a hindrance to trade, these fledgling maritime communities thrive from the active support of global piracy committed against traditional enemies, nominally at peace with England. In times of economic distress, these men represented a real as well as a symbolic challenge to the legal and commercial policies formulated by a distant and often ineffectual administrative body back in London. They considered them these policies that hindered prosperity and often the defense of the colonies. Although pirates could be found in nearly every Atlantic port city, only particular locations at particular moments earned international reputations as pirate nests, which is a pejorative term used by royal officials. Many of the most notorious pirates began their careers in these ports, while many others settled down there to become respected members of the local elite. So by focusing on the relationship of high seas marauding with landed communities, we have to rethink everything we thought we knew about piracy during its golden age, which is roughly 1570 to 1740. More importantly, this connection forces us to rethink how we imagine maritime history as a largely deep sea project. And of course, it's very appropriate to be here in Birch Aquarium, people who study the deep sea. This book tells an entirely new story about the tumultuous early formation of the British Empire and the essential role that maritime depredation and violence played in the development of what would eventually become the United States. One way of thinking about this is based on the image that's on the cover of my book. This is Robert Rich, the second Earl of Warwick. He inherited a fleet of ships from his very wealthy father. He was a Puritan. He doesn't look like a Puritan in this picture, but that's, Puritans are not necessarily the way you imagine it. When he inherited this fleet of ships, he sent his captains out plundering the Mughal Empire in the Indian Ocean, and then subsequently the Spanish and Portuguese Catholic shipping in the Atlantic. Yet at the same time, his pirate captains also were essential in the formation of the first English communities, transporting the first immigrants to Jamestown, to Bermuda, New Plymouth, Massachusetts Bay, and Jamaica. They provided an essential supply line to those founding colonies, and their plunder provided financial backing to those endeavors. There was no money to be made in Jamestown, in New Plymouth. The money was made plundering in the Caribbean. So they did that along their way. So I purposely picked someone who supported pirates, not an actual pirate, for the cover of my book, because that's what I was really interested in. And I picked someone who was really interested in colonization and radical Protestantism, as well as plunder, because they were deeply interrelated. My book traces the transformation of colonial communities from centuries of support to the period where they were no longer supported between 1716 to 1726, a period known as the War on Pirates, when colonial communities actually began to hunt pirates rather than support them. And during this period, scores of pirates were executed along the North American seaboard. If pirates were actively supported during the years prior to 1716, really a century and a half, it begs a very simple question that many of my students ask, is it true that somehow pirates were different than common sailors or even the local communities that supported them on land? In fact, the popular imagination of pirates is radically different from other sailors has contributed to the notion that they spoke their own language, hence the success of International Talk Like a Pirate Day. Does anybody know about this? It actually is an international movement. September 19th every single year. It also contributes to the idea that if you actually go to your Facebook page, you can change the language to pirates. Do people know this too? Okay. My work actually challenges this to an extent. In fact, the way you think pirates speak actually comes from this man, Robert Newton, who decided when he was playing Long John Silver in the 1950 Treasure Island movie, he decided to go "Arr" for the first time. Before that, no one really did this. So this one person changed the history of piracy. So from the period before 1716, it actually makes more sense to describe someone as a sailor who had committed an act of piracy in a long and complicated and varied career rather than a static image of a pirate, right? Because people ask me all the time, do pirates look like this, speak like this? Instead, think of it, piracy as an act in a long, complex career. Another way of thinking about this is imagine a child stealing candy, you know, at age 12, and they're caught by their parents, and they're embarrassed, and they're punished. But then they go on to live a nice, fruitful life. They go through adulthood without ever committing an act of theft again. It'd be ludicrous to look at that person and call them a thief, right? And imagine if this person grows up, gets a PhD, and becomes a well-known historian. You'd rather call them a professor rather than an actual criminal. And this is true of piracy. People committed acts of piracy among a long spectrum of behaviors. So certainly there were a number of wild captains of legendary status who would never consider legitimate commerce as a way of life. But there were far more who hoped to settle down on land and at least receive a pardon, which in fact was remarkably common. One pirate even married the daughter of the governor of Pennsylvania. So with so many welcoming ports, a merry life, yet a short one, was not the motto of most pirates during the 17th century. My book is based on archival research performed throughout the United States, Great Britain, as well as Bermuda. And much of that research was performed with the help, generous help, of UC San Diego and the Academic Senate. I'll give you just one example, with time constraints, of a kind of document that I read and one I found in the British Library. What you're looking at is a petition from the wives of pirates who were based in Madagascar plundering the Indian Ocean in 1708. These women begged to have their husbands sent home because they couldn't take care of their families, and they were saying, we're in poverty. Our husbands are incredibly wealthy. If you send them home, we'll give the treasury half of what they have, and the other half we'll keep and take care of our families. These men knew that returning to London was actually never going to happen. It wasn't an option for most sea rovers. But they knew that the North American colonies was an option, and many did move to places like Newport, Rhode Island, and Charleston, South Carolina. One name that's interesting is the very first name to sign this petition. You can see there in the very bottom left, if you can see that there. The name is Mary Read, and some of you might know or recognize the name Mary Read. Mary Read is the name of an actual female pirate. It's a woman we know she lived. She was executed for piracy in 1721. We have her trial record. We can imagine if she was a woman whose husband became a pirate in the Indian Ocean, was never pardoned after her petition, so she herself took to the seas in revenge of her husband's inability to ever come home. Is this true? I don't know. It can't be for certain. But it is amazing to imagine the possibility. So my goal has been to put men who committed acts of piracy, committed piratical acts, into their very specific historical context, rather than categorize them as a simple or static pirate. As a historian, I try to understand why someone in Rhode Island could feel comfortable welcoming a sailor who arrived in a Newport tavern with Arabian gold, clearly stolen by violence from an allied shipping in the Mughal Empire in India. This is an actual piece of gold found in a dig site in Rhode Island. The knee-jerk reaction is to assume, of course, this is all about corruption and greed. But the more time I spent in archives, the more I realized that it was about much more than that. My book provides a wide array of particular contexts, from a loose legal system surrounding maritime warfare, a political regime that put a great deal of power in local governors over a distant monarch, an economic system that seemed crippling, a corrupt East India Company monopoly that prevented the colonial gentry from acquiring heavily desired luxury goods like silk and calico. So understanding context requires honing a historian's most important skill, which is empathy. And I mean to grasp the full context of someone's life from the past, someone so incredibly far and distant from you. Again, this is not the same as sympathy. I don't ask my students to feel bad for people in the past. Oh, it smelled bad back in the day, and they were always in pain. This is a skill I think that every one of our undergraduates needs to work on every single day of their lives. And this is what historians do for a living, and we are in many ways the best to train them to do so. I have to, in fact, perform a radical form of empathy in the sense that I have to understand the context for the violent actions of pirates like Blackbeard, a man who tied matchsticks to the ends of the curls at the ends of his beard so that when he boarded a ship, his face was engulfed in smoke. Right? Especially following such a divisive election, where those who did not vote with you seem to inhabit a wholly separate universe from your own, it's imperative to invoke your power of empathy to grasp why they voted the way they did. Again, this is not a call for sympathy, but to understand the context. And empathy is essential in a well-functioning democracy. In my courses, I have my students work on their ability to empathize with those in the past by trying to construct their own histories based on original documents and sources from the past. History is in part the story that we tell based on the evidence we have available to us. I tell my students to come with what I call willful naivete. And what I mean by that is they have so many preconceptions about the history of piracy, what piracy is all about, what pirates look like, and I say, erase everything. Start fresh. And then you're going to go into the archive, and you're going to read the original documents, and then you are going to become historians, and you're going to make history, and you're going to describe what we know about pirates based on the history that you construct. UCSD is uniquely situated to do this kind of tactile experience because we happen to have one of the greatest collections of original documents on the history of piracy in our special collections library. And many of these are part of the Hill Collection of Pacific Voyages, where I am the curator. Linda Clausen, who is here over in the corner, wait, put your hand up real quick, Linda. Linda Clausen, who is here, and her team of diligent librarians help my students find and work with documents so they themselves can make history. Sometimes we purchase manuscript materials like original ship's logbooks that have never been analyzed by historians before. And they might have been sitting in someone's attic for centuries. Our students then might be the first to uncover these invaluable treasures for future scholars. Sometimes empathizing with life at sea is really hard to do in a seminar room. So sometimes you have to take your students to sea. Again, UC San Diego is uniquely situated to provide that unforgettable experience because we happen to live only a few miles from one of the world's greatest maritime museums. Students in my Age of Sail course can actually handle sail aboard the Californian, which is the official tall ship of the state of California. And here you see faculty, graduate students, and undergraduates all working together equally before the mast. Soon, my students will be able to sail on the remarkable San Salvador, which is a replica of the first European ship sailed by Juan Cabrillo into San Diego Harbor in 1542. And if you haven't seen it, I ask you to please go downtown and check it out. I have not actually been sailing on it yet, because I don't think I'm allowed to, but I've been on it, so very soon. And then during the summer, we're actually going to host an event that will involve UCSD alumni and donors to go in the San Salvador, and I will be there, so you're welcome to join us. These voyages are captained by UC San Diego alumnus and director of the Maritime Museum, Ray Ashley, who's a very good friend of UCSD campus and has been a very good friend of mine. This kind of community engagement is only one part of a broad vision plan for the new Institute of Arts and Humanities founded this summer, where I am the associate director. We support programming that brings UC San Diego to the community and the community to UC San Diego. To empathize is to try to understand what it means to be human and what it is that we all share. And this is what the new Institute of Arts and Humanities is all about. So let me conclude by asking if you have any questions about piracy, about the archives, and about the new Institute of Arts and Humanities. And thank you for being here tonight. How many undergraduates are history majors? The answer is not enough. That's my mathematical answer. In fact, we have one of the strongest history departments in the country. Arts and Humanities, I think they were 33 in the U.S. News and World Report last year. They're now 23. 23 in the world, Arts and Humanities. 23 in the world. Just let that sink in for a second. And yet we're considered a STEM school. 23 in the world, and we're a STEM school. So in many ways, this has been a frustration. And we really need you all to go out there and be proselytized for the arts and humanities, to go out there on our behalf and speak for us. And the fact that this is not self-evident. Yes? In my own work, I talk about it in my class. So the question was, do I talk about Pacific pirates at all in my own work? I do a little bit in my class. I'm actually working on an article project that does involve Chinese pirates from the early 18th century, and there actually were a number of female Chinese pirates who were very well known. Actually, they were Lady Chang, who was actually leading. But one question that I have, though, about this is, one of the questions about piracy is this question of scale. Once you get to 100,000 people, are they pirates anymore, or is that a nation state? And that actually is a question I have sometimes with South China, which is, are these pirates, or are these called pirates because the emperor considers them pirates, or is this a separate political regime? So the general question was about the significance of the Barbary pirates to the sort of the formation of the early Republic, early America, to an extent. So Barbary pirates were part. I write about them. It's in the book. It's an important part of the book, but I don't talk about the early Republic. But I talk about an earlier period. The Barbary pirates were pirates based in North Africa, the city-states of places like Algiers, Tunis, Mamoura, which is part of Morocco, and Tripoli. And they preyed upon Mediterranean shipping. A lot of this had to do with the part of the post-Reconquista period, meaning after the Spanish booted out North Africans, and they were sort of had a period of long centuries of revenge against Christian shipping. And this continued for centuries. And the period after the American Revolution, all of a sudden, the British Royal Navy was no longer protecting American ships, and Americans were forced to fight the Barbary Pirates. So really the first war in defense of the United States was a war against the Barbary Pirates. And so that is very true. That actually was, it was a it was actually, I'll tell you what's important about it as the formation, for the formation of the United States. It was one of the first really unifying moments. It was one of the first moments where Virginians and Bostonians could actually share something together that they were equally afraid of, which is captivity to Barbary Pirates. So the question was, what motivates pirates, right? So in my book, I actually talk about multiple motivations. Obviously, greed is going to be a motivation. You're going to be inspired to obtain riches to an extent. But there are many other motivations, and there are other justifications. Many of it had to do with religion. And one of the reasons I brought up Robert Rich, he felt justified in sending his captains out around the world because he was a radical Protestant. And he really felt like part of the Reformation was attacking Islam. So he felt justified in sending his ships out to the Indian Ocean. As part of the radical Reformation, he felt like attacking Catholicism was necessary as part of the Reformation. So he felt comfortable attacking the Spanish and Portuguese. So this man felt very justified in religious purposes for what he did. Religion is brought up all the time. And it's a justification among others. Other issues, again, justifications or motivations, again, would have been imperial, just imperial contests, that the desires to take one island from another island or seize parts of Panama. So there's big, broad questions that have to do with imperialism, religion, politics, and then smaller ones that are individual greed and self-desire. So welcome. Thank you all. And enjoy the rest of your evening tonight.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.